This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
There are all sorts of regulations in the Hebrew Bible about what you must do before you take a captive woman for your wife. But it doesn't say, and you're allowed to rape the women.
Rabbi Wolpe, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You are obviously one of the country's most prominent rabbis. You are obviously passionate about the work that you do. But for all of your passion and all of your influence and all of your prominence, you would acknowledge, would you not, that non-Orthodox Judaism in this country is, if not dying, then certainly in very, very serious trouble.
I don't think there's any question about the fact that all what I would call non-literalist faiths, Judaism prominent among them, are in trouble in part because we ask great commitments from people, especially Judaism, which is countercultural and difficult to live in some ways. And the motivation used to be because God told you to. Once the force of that rationale
For me, it was because my mother told me to.
The same thing.
Yeah, okay.
But once the force of that rationale is weakened, it becomes a lot harder. All of the seductions of the culture fight against it. So, for example, to tell someone that Saturday is the Sabbath and you should not go out to restaurants and you shouldn't spend money and you shouldn't drive, well, that's very countercultural in America, hard to observe, and I think, understandably, unless you live in a fairly enclosed and very traditional community, it's going to start to disappear.
When we talk about the state of Judaism in this country, Exhibit A has to be that Pew Research Center report
right. That
came out a couple years ago, right. Which, as you know, was the product of a massive survey of American
Yes. Jews.
According to that survey, the intermarriage rate now among non-Orthodox Jews is 72%. The report also found that roughly 1 in 3 of all American Jews born after 1980 say they have no religion whatsoever, and only 1/3 of American Jews now belong to a synagogue.
Right.
These are terrible numbers, aren't they?
They are if you care about the future of Judaism. You have to search the report for the nuggets of optimism, which are there if you look for them.
Uh-huh.
What you discover is that those families that give their children an intensive Jewish education, that is day schools, Jewish summer camps, trips to Israel, do much, much better than the statistics that you're quoting.
I guess I should disclose that I went to Hebrew school and was bar mitzvahed at a suburban conservative synagogue. And I have to say, you know, given that experience and mm-hmm. others, I have come to think of conservative Judaism as the CNN of Judaism. And what I mean by that is just as the cable news network positions itself between Fox News on the right. And MSNBC on the left, conservative Judaism, it seems to me, has worked very hard to try to stake out a position between Reform and New Age Judaism on the left and the more orthodox fundamental denominations on the right. Is that a fair characterization?
I'm going to give you a very Jewish answer. Yes and no.
Okay.
The yes part is conservative Judaism was actually in Eastern Europe a break off from orthodoxy and a break off from Reform both. The attempt wasn't to stake a middle position. The attempt was to stake a modern Judaism with traditional elements. What happens in America is that the middle road is the hardest. It's hardest even when you speak of it in media terms. If somebody is a passionate leftist or a passionate conservative, their voice tends to be louder than the person who says, you know, there are elements to both your positions that make sense. Let's be reasonable. Let's be calm. That's not a position that generally tends to evoke a great deal of passion. Having said that, there are things I think about conservative Judaism that make it not a compromise between two places, but its own particular ideology. And those are precisely the things, as a conservative Jew, that I need to be able to enunciate in order to draw people to it.
Right, because the rap is that in the effort to be accommodating, conservative Judaism ends up looking confused and unprincipled.
Well, this is partly a historical phenomenon, because when Judaism in the 40s and 50s in America, when Judaism was developing its character, what happened was that there were massive defections from Orthodoxy. And so conservative Judaism was by far the largest denomination, didn't want to define itself because it was afraid if it did, it would lose a good part of its population, and so stayed deliberately loosely defined, which in today's world is a demerit, not a virtue.
Yeah, and let me give you an example of what I'm talking about here in terms of this inclination to split the difference and how that may not necessarily be satisfying. Back in 2006... the highest legal body in conservative Judaism was called the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards of the Rabbinical Assembly. It voted to allow rabbis to perform commitment ceremonies for same-sex couples, which at the time was a very progressive thing to do, except that in that same decision, the committee stipulated that these couples that were being celebrated and acknowledged were still prohibited from committing sodomy. And that was the word that was used.
No, actually, that's not actually exactly correct.
No? Okay.
No. There was a one responsum that said that in the committee. It wasn't the committee
that
said
binding?
That. No, absolutely
not.
It was one responsum in the committee that said that. But I know, and so do others, that I do gay marriage ceremonies. A lot of other conservative rabbis do, with no such stipulation, and would never suggest such a thing to anyone.
So that stipulation was never a binding.
It was not binding. It was one opinion that some people agreed with, but not very many.
Okay.
For exactly the reason that you would assume.
Right. So I want to tell you a little bit about my sister.
Okay.
She's not exactly an observant Jew, but she did feel strongly enough about her Jewish identity to not want to be married by her fiancé's Catholic priest without a rabbi on hand to co-officiate. And actually, it was a very interesting ceremony because the rabbi she chose came to the wedding obviously believing that it was his job to do as much as he could to make sure that the priest didn't get a word in edgewise. And so the priest would begin to say something, and the rabbi would immediately interrupt him with an anecdote or an observation, and after a while it really started to piss the priest off. Mm-hmm. But it was a very interesting ceremony for that reason. But let's say for a moment that my sister came to you and said, "I want you, Rabbi, to co-officiate at my wedding." What would you say to her?
I would say to her that unfortunately I can't, and the reason that I can't, although I hope very much that after she's married that we will, and even before we can develop a relationship, I'd like to get to know her husband, I'd like to get to know her children, I'd love for them to be part of my synagogue. The reason that I can't officiate at the wedding is twofold. First of all, the Pew study that you quoted, the vast majority of Jews who intermarry don't raise their children as Jews, which means that I'm presiding over a ceremony, the odds of which are that I'm presiding over a ceremony that's going to be detrimental to the cause to which I've given my life, and that is the perpetuation of Judaism. The other reason I can't is that my presence there is I marry people according to Jewish law. That's why I'm there. A rabbi is at a ceremony because the groom says to the bride and the bride to the groom, "I'm marrying you kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, according to the laws of Moses and Israel." Well, if one person isn't Jewish, those laws don't apply, so my presence is a sort of mockery of what it is I'm supposed to be doing.
But here's the thing. Aren't the biblical injunctions against homosexuality much more explicit than the injunctions against intermarriage?
Yes and no. It depends how
very standard answer
for
you.
Well, yes, it is. That's twice I've given you yes and no. They are in some ways, and in other ways they're not. That is, you can find ways around them, and you can find legal niceties that allow you to to do the ceremony, even though it is untraditional. What you can't find, though, and I don't think is real, is that you're presiding over something that is ultimately destructive to the Jewish people.
What about all those wives Solomon had, the 700 wives?
A lot of them weren't Jewish.
Yeah.
But the tradition doesn't approve of that. If you're asking me, do people in the Bible do things that the Jewish tradition doesn't approve of, I can give you a long list. I just finished writing a book about David. David does a lot of stuff that the Jewish tradition does not approve of.
How fundamental to Judaism is the notion that the Jews are God's chosen people?
It is fundamental to Judaism that Jews are God's chosen people, but it is not fundamental to Judaism that Jews are the only chosen people.
That Who else is chosen? I wasn't told.
I'm perfectly happy to have Christians believe that they're chosen for certain tasks. In fact, a famous Jewish philosopher, Franz Rosenzweig, said that the Jews were the sun and the Christians were the rays of the sun. That is, the Christians spread that monotheistic message to the world. Could say the same thing about Islam. So the idea that different peoples have different tasks in the world, that God chooses different peoples for different things, I think is perfectly consistent, and I'm perfectly comfortable with that. It's clear to me that Jews historically have had a very powerful mission. We introduced the idea of one God to the world. We've made, I think, wildly, almost unimaginably disproportionate contributions to the world. But that doesn't mean that other peoples haven't done important and extraordinary things as well.
But, you know, in the Hebrew school education that I got told me that, well, yeah, these other people may have been kind of chosen, but we are the real chosen
Jews. But you asked me what I think.
Yeah, right. So was I taught something fallacious?
You were taught something, I think, that is inconsistent with our understanding of our place in a world in which people don't live anymore among untutored peasants and think of themselves as the only educated people in the world. When you look around the world, I think there's no way that you can maintain the stance that, you know, we are the only ones that have insight X, Y, or Z. That's just not true.
Do you think that the Jewish notion of chosenness contributes at all to a common feeling that many converts have, that no matter how observant they might be, they will always remain second-class Jews?
I know people that have been married into families for 30 years, but they still feel like since they weren't born into it, they still feel a certain distance from it. I think that's inevitable.
Is that a problem in Judaism, do you think?
It's a strength and a problem. Like everything, every blessing has, you know.
And it's another yes and no answer.
Abba even once said that Jews like their clouds without silver linings. Uh-huh. But this, I actually think that this cloud has a silver lining. That is, it's a problem to the person who converts, but you can't have a strong, cohesive group without a sense someone who comes from the outside, that they're entering this strong, cohesive group, and it takes a lot of work to get accepted.
In addition to work, let's say you're an adult male,
okay,
and you'd like to convert and you're not circumcised. My understanding is most rabbis will not recognize you as Jewish.
They will ask you to be circumcised.
Unless and until you have this, your penile foreskin surgically removed.
Yes.
And that has to be a pretty significant deterrent for a lot of new age pain sensitive guys.
Not only that, it was a deterrent when Paul eliminated that requirement thousands of years ago to enable people to become Christians.
Right.
Yes, it is a deterrent. What do you want me to say?
And again, the demographic distress that your denomination doesn't compel you to maybe re-examine that?
I don't think, if I really thought that the one thing that was holding back the explosion of Jewish population was the issue of circumcision, I might be persuaded to re-examine that. But I don't actually think that that's the principle. I don't think there are all these people who say, you know what, I would be Jewish if only you take the circumcision thing away.
So if a new Pew Research Center report
says that the one thing that is
you're ready
then
to
re-examine. I'm willing to discuss it.
Okay. When you're talking to Jews, and in particular young liberal Jews, and the surveys I've seen all suggest that most Jews are still liberal. Mm-hmm. When you're talking to these folks, how much of a liability would you say is this Old Testament God who so often in the Bible comes across, at least to me, as brutal, cruel, and emotionally unstable?
Emotionally unstable?
Absolutely.
So I would say a lot of what Judaism is about is how the rabbis read the Bible much more than what the Bible says. And that's why Judaism is not, in that sense, a fundamentalist tradition, because no Jew will ever say to you when you ask for an answer to a question, just open the Bible.
Okay, well, when I open up the Bible, I read in one passage that God is testing Abraham
yes.
by making him choose between Abraham's belief in God and the life of his son. I open it up another place in the Bible, and I see that God is killing the firstborn child in every Egyptian household. And in yet another passage, I see that God is telling Moses to slaughter 300 of his own people, 3,000 of his own people, because they worshipped a golden calf.
Which one would you like me to address? Because there are answers to all those and to others.
All right, let's talk.
And if I say to you, for example, if I say to you, on the other hand, if you turn to the New Testament, then you discover that eternal punishment is condemned for anyone who doesn't believe in Jesus. And that seems a much crueler God than a God.
Well, we're not talking about Christianity.
But, well, you are, though. You're saying, is it a disability when you look at the Old Testament God? So I'm saying not as compared to the New Testament God, who seems to me epically cruel, who's condemning billions of people to eternal damnation. That doesn't happen in the Hebrew Bible. Why don't you ask me about that
one? But that's your response, that the New Testament
It's one of them.
Okay. How about the slaughtering of 3,000 people for worshiping a golden calf?
Well, the idea behind the death of the Israelites in the desert is that God wants a free people to be able to take the land of Israel. And again, the Israelites prove with the spies, with the golden calf, that they're not actually prepared to go into the land of Israel, that they still have the mentality of slaves and they have to die in the desert. Some die brutally and some die by natural means.
But isn't it true, as the Jews make their way to the Promised Land, God is sanctioning genocide, rape?
I don't think God sanctions rape. Where does God sanction rape?
I think that in Deuteronomy, I think that 2013,
yes.
In the cities God delivereth, kill all the males, but the women shall thou take unto yourself.
Right. They're made wives. They're assimilated into the Israelite.
Oh, they're consenting women?
Into the Israelite.
I didn't get the consenting
part. Well, you actually can get the consenting part. In the ancient world, sure. Because in the ancient world, what happens is when you conquer a city, you do kill all the males. I mean, it's a brutal world. You should read Steven Pinker's Better Angels of Our Nature.
I did read it.
So you can see how this was a universal practice in the ancient world among the Israelites and others. Once a woman loses her male protection, she's alone in the world. If you killed all the men and just left the women there, they would be literally all alone. There are all sorts of regulations in the Hebrew Bible about what you must do before you take a captive woman for your wife. But it doesn't say, and you're allowed to rape the women. It says you can take them and they get assimilated and into Israelite homes and so on, which in the standard of the time, obviously today is much more primitive than anything we would do. The standard of the time is actually fairly developed. And again, the rabbinic regulations are the way in which a Jew reads this Torah. So
you caused something of a sensation back in 2001 when you gave a Passover sermon.
I did.
In which you acknowledged that the extensive archaeological evidence that we now have strongly suggests that the Exodus story, as it's told in the Bible, never happened.
Nope, didn't say that.
You didn't say that.
Nope.
Let me.
I can quote exactly what I said.
I have a quote right here. Let me read it. See
sure.
if it jives
yes.
with your memory. You told your congregants, the truth is that virtually every modern archaeologist
right.
who has investigated the story of the Exodus, with very few exceptions, agrees that the way the Bible describes the Exodus is not the way it happened, if it happened at all.
Exactly, which is different from saying it probably never happened.
Okay.
I said it clearly didn't happen the way it happened in the Bible, if it happened.
Was there massive Hebrew Exodus?
No,
from
but there was
Egypt?
Almost there. No, there was almost certainly some escape of some small number of slaves who preserve a historical memory that was woven into the Exodus story. But I'm not a biblical literalist anyway. Mm-hmm. I believe that the Bible is something that was compiled over a long period of time from many different strands of tradition. So that doesn't upset me or upend my religious conviction.
But if all this archaeological evidence suggests that that story is if not entirely myth, mm-hmm. then largely myth,
yes.
then what relevance does it have for today's Jews? I mean, why would today's Jews find that story any more sacred than, say, the story of Odysseus or Robin Hood?
For a couple of reasons.
Or King Arthur.
First of all, because it's a story of your family diary. It's what happened to your ancestors or how your ancestors remember what happened to them. And second, because for thousands of years, that's the story that has sustained the Jewish people.
And what's the moral of the Exodus story?
The moral of the Exodus story is that God helps people be free in order to do something important and transcendent in this world. It's not only that you left Egypt, it's also that you were on your way to Sinai. It's not only freedom from, but freedom to.
Does the moral authority of that story at all suffer from the fact that those Jews portrayed in that story were themselves slaveholders?
No, yes and no.
They enslaved Jews as well as non-Jews, right?
Yes, because in the ancient world, there weren't, when you had debts, that was how you paid off your debts, was through slavery.
Yeah. And God endorsed the Old Testament. Everyone endorsed it.
I mean, Greek slaves endorsed slavery. Yeah. Nobody could imagine a world in which slavery didn't exist.
Right. But from a modern person's standpoint, here's what I would say to that modern person. Yeah.
Who stopped slavery? The place in the world that stopped slavery were the places that were inspired by the Exodus tradition and by the Western tradition that flowed from it, Judaism and Christianity. So I would say, yes, in the world in which that story happened, everyone believed that a certain amount of slavery was acceptable. But that story was the only thing that led ultimately to a worldwide movement that liberated people from slavery. And every person who did that, Wilberforce and Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, they all quoted the Exodus story.
Right.
So they didn't quote Odysseus.
But then the defenders of slavery also quoted the Bible. I guess
they did, but they lost. Yeah. They did, but they lost. And the reason they lost is because the predominance of the biblical tradition is every human being is in the image of God. That's how the Bible starts. It doesn't start with Jews. It starts with people. Adam isn't a Jew, which means every human being is in the image of God. And the people who argued against it were right. It is certainly true that you can use biblical verses to defend all sorts of terrible things. There's no question about it, but there's no book and no principle that people won't bend to their will, good or bad.
As a rabbi, do you think it is possible to behave in a way that's theologically correct yet morally reprehensible?
No, because theologically, the fundamental theological statement that the Bible makes is that all people are in God's image, and that means that everybody's related, everyone is a child of God. And the great innovation of the Ten Commandments is that God cares about how I treat you.
So when
the pagan gods of the ancient world only cared how you treated them.
So when Moses slaughtered those 3,000 Jews who worshipped that golden calf, was he...
It was either theologically correct or morally reprehensible, but it couldn't be both.
Mm. So which do you think it was?
I assume, if it in fact happened, that it was a... How I think the best way to put it is a benighted understanding of what it is that God wants.
Mm-hmm. Theologically correct.
No, it's not theologically correct if it's a benighted understanding of what God wants.
So it was not theologically correct and it was morally reprehensible.
Yes, although it was culturally understandable and maybe even essential for the survival of the tribe at the time.
Does that justify it?
It comes close. One of the things that we don't like is that sometimes horrible things happen, especially in the ancient world, horrible things happen without which people wouldn't be able to survive.
Yeah.
That's a difficult thing.
For those of us who do, and I have to include myself in this, who do not find the Old Testament God either plausible or particularly attractive, does Judaism have room for Spinoza's God? We know that in 1656, the Jewish community that existed in Amsterdam didn't have any room for Spinoza himself.
Right. We don't know why, though.
We don't know why.
But
we could make some educated guesses.
But we don't know why. But yeah, I mean, Maimonides' God is very different from the God of the Bible.
Spinoza's God is a God that does not answer prayers, does not perform miracles, does not love us, does not hate us, and is certainly not in the business of choosing anyone.
Yes.
Is that a God that, Judaism can embrace?
Many Jews have thought so.
What do you think?
I think you could build a Judaism around Spinoza's God. It would be essentially a deistic Judaism, which is very different from the Judaism of most of history. But you could build a Judaism around it. Yeah.
That's a pragmatic response.
Right.
What about a religious response?
I would say the reason that I would not say no is because I know that there are Jewish theologians who essentially have. So, yes. What I wonder always, since the question of the show is about the future, is whether such a Judaism could sustain itself. And that I don't know.
I have one last question for
you.
There is this politically correct notion out there that the major religions of the world are really just variations on a theme, that they all embrace in some form the golden rule, and that the rest of it is just footnotes.
Yeah.
That's the argument. And I'm not sure that that's true. But let's suppose for a moment that non-Orthodox Judaism was to disappear or be absorbed into something else to the point where it's no longer recognizable as Judaism. If that were to happen, why exactly would that be a tragedy for the world?
So I think it would be a tragedy on three separate levels. First is Judaism has an astonishing history of producing people of great drive, energy, talent, and ability. And I would argue that that's not a genetic factor. It's a cultural factor. There's something about the Jewish tradition that generates such people, and the world would lose them, and that would be terrible. The fact that we're less than 1% of the world's population and won over 20% of the Nobel Prizes is inexplicable, other than the Jewish tradition has something in it that is important. Second, the world would lose much of its history. We are the foundation stone upon which Christianity and Islam were built, and we remain as the living embodiment of that history, and it would be a shame to lose that. And then third, there are the unique contributions that I believe Judaism makes. It is a tradition that's based on argument and on exactly what we were doing today. This is an extraordinarily Jewish conversation. If you open the Talmud, on every page there are a series of objections and questions and so on. The Talmud is a constant argument. And that intellectual disposition, that is believing in redemption but being skeptical of it, the humor with which we deflate our own grand conceptions, and there's a reason why humor is so much a part of the Jewish tradition. All of that is a way of being in the world that I think is an important religious and cultural contribution. And lastly, I'm going to say something that I think will take you aback and you won't agree with, which is if Jews disappeared from the world in some way, I think God would be sad.
Well, on that note, Rabbi, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you. Pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.